Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Many Californians would be surprised to learn that the third largest watershed in the state is the Eel River. I know I was. Named by white settlers for the lampreys they saw there, this magnificent wild and scenic river system has its headwaters just north of the San Francisco Bay Area. It wends its way through redwood forests and magnificent coastal mountains before reaching its destination in the Pacific just south of Humboldt Bay. Later on in the show, we'll learn about this and other fisheries in the state when we profile the newly reborn periodical California Fly Fisher. We'll be speaking with publisher Tracy Diaz and editor-at-large George Revelle. California Fly Fisher is a beautiful magazine that can be enjoyed by both fly anglers like me and those who are just interested in California's incredibly diverse waters. But first, let's take a deep dive into the natural and human history of the Eel River system with our guest Charles Schneider from California Trout. Raised by loggers in Northern California, Charles is a connectivity program manager for California Trout, and he joins us now from his home in Petaluma, California. Charles Schneider, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're talking about the Eel River and the Eel River watershed. So before we go any farther, for people who aren't familiar with that neck of the woods, it's a pretty big neck of the woods, isn't it? Tell us where it is.
Yeah, so the Eel watershed is the third largest watershed entirely in California. And it drains the better part of four counties sort of in northwestern California. So the headwaters are in Mendocino and Lake counties. And it's kind of an interesting river in that it sort of flows south to north. And the mouth of the Eel River is in Humboldt County, sort of just south of the town of Eureka. So it's about a 3,500 square mile watershed, and it's big.
Yeah, it kind of goes all the way from just north of the wine country all the way to the very north coast. It really is a huge area, isn't it?
Yeah, it's massive. And I think a lot of people that have been through that area, you know, and driven up Highway 101 from, you know, say Willits to Eureka, you know, that is the South Fork of the Eel River. And so a lot of people think of that as the main stem Eel River, but the main stem itself, you know, that drains the vast majority of the watershed is actually, you know, a ridgeline or two over to the east. In a part of the state that there just aren't not a lot of paved roads in.
Yeah, which makes it, you know, incredibly wild. And speaking of which, a lot of the Eel River is designated as wild and scenic river areas by, you know, the federal government. So, and it's pretty important that way too, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, both state and federal wild and scenic listings, and it's one of the earliest rivers in the state to have that designation.
Well, tell us about what makes it special that way. Why is it such a special river? Because for people that have never been there or experienced it, it's hard to describe how beautiful it is. But could give us a sense of why it's such a special region.
Well, I think, you know, the eel in my mind, and this kind of comes from my fisheries and geomorphology and river nerd background. It's really neat because it's sort of a young river in that it's actively sort of down cutting through the mountains. And you know, sort of one of the fun facts about the eel is it has the highest sediment load of any river of its size in the lower 48. So it's a very active river in terms of its ability to change and move big rocks. And that's what gives it really its sort of dramatic looks. As you get down to the lower Eel, it's of course redwood country, and all that sediment drops out and provides nutrients for, you know, the world's tallest trees, which is sort of the section of the Eel people are probably most familiar with. So it really does kind of have it all in a single river basin. You know, and our organization is so interested in the Eel because historically it was one of the most productive salmon rivers in all of California.
Another thing that's interesting about it from a geomorphology point of view and just the river system is it's got very highly variable flows, doesn't it?
Yeah, we call it flashy is sort of the colloquial term for that. But yeah, I mean, in the summer months, flows can get, you know, really low in the tens of cubic feet per second. And in the wintertime, it can be in the hundreds of thousands of cubic feet per second. So it really is a river that had us sort of four seasons and Looks very different depending on the time of year that you see it.
Yeah, those are some huge swings and flows. And of course, California trout is very interested in the Eel River because of the fish that have lived there historically. Tell us about the species that are there and why the eel is so important to them.
Yeah, so there's of course dozens and dozens of native species that live in the Eel River Basin. Here at Caltrout, we're primarily interested in salmonids, and so coho salmon, Chinook salmon, which are of course the sort of the commercially important species these days, steelhead trout, which are really important to recreational anglers, and then the eels, also the southernmost extent of coastal cutthroat trout, which are a really cool spotty species that tend to prefer estuaries.
Do they go out to sea, those cutthroat trout?
Yeah, they can. Huh. Like steelhead. Uh-huh. Steelhead are the anadromous form. Anadromous means ocean going. So they're just a anadromous form of rainbow trout, which people are pretty familiar with generally. And we just like to say they make a different lifestyle choice. So cutthroat are similar in that they can have both ocean going and, fully freshwater life histories.
And let's talk about the historic conservation issues, because I've seen and read and seen some films showing just how productive a fishery it was back, 100 years ago. It was just such a productive fishery. And you hear this all the time about just about everywhere where people talk about, well, you could walk across the back of the fish, that they were so thick in the river. Tell us about, what were some of the things that caused the decline of that fishery?
Yeah, so, interestingly enough, several years ago, Caltrout commissioned a study with Dr. Peter Moyle at UC Davis to try to get a handle on what those historic populations were in the Eel River. And they went back and they looked at cannery records on the Eel River. So, historically, California Gold Rush era, 1850s, 1860s, to feed the miners, a bunch of salmon canneries were set up in the Sacramento River system. And as fisheries were depleted there, those cannery operators kind of started marching up the coast, looking for new rivers to exploit. And the eel was one of them. And so using those cannery records, the researchers were able to sort of, back into historic numbers. And it really surprised all of us, I think, what they found, which was in good years, up to a million fish in the Eel River across all species. And, looking at size data for the fish that were caught, a big portion of those, up to 800,000, would have been Chinook salmon. So again, those Chinook are sort of the largest bodied, most commercially important salmon. So an extremely productive river. And we now know populations are somewhere between 1% and 5% of that. We see,
wow. That's under 10,000. Quite a decline.
Yeah, it's a huge decline. And, when we talk about the reasons, it really is death by 1,000 cuts.
Well, let's get into those 1,000 cuts, because there have been so many different things, like overfishing, but commercially. And then I also gather that there was some overfishing done by recreational fishers. Those things contributed, right?
Yeah, a lot of the impacts, and this, I think, while we talk about sort of the negatives, right, and the depressing stuff, a lot of this gives me a lot of hope, because a lot of the things that led us down this path of these fisheries being reduced, we are seeing positive change. So on the fishery side, I mentioned those cannery records, a lot of that catch was done with gill nets that were strung across the river, and they would take every single fish that came through. So historic overfishing, absolutely, both commercially and recreationally. We have some pretty strong commercial and recreational fishing regulations in place now. I think we generally do a pretty darn good job of managing those fisheries as best we can. So yeah, historic overharvest, absolutely. Logging, particularly in the tractor logging area in the 1950s and 60s, dumped huge amounts of sediment into these rivers, removed, entire riparian corridors. And modern forest practice rules have, by and large outlawed those most destructive practices that we had back then. And in modern era, the green rush and cannabis, hundreds and hundreds of distributed water diversions across tributary streams Those small tributary streams are critically important for juvenile salmon as they sort of make it through their first year of life, especially for coho and steelhead. So, yeah, absolutely, the green rush, lots of illegal road building and grading and pesticides associated with that as well. And then, really, since the 1980s, this non-native species in the Eel River, Sacramento pike minnow, was introduced and has really just exploded in terms of numbers. And these are large-bodied piscivorous fish. They eat baby salmon, is the simple way to say it. And their biomass has just exploded in the Eel River. So this is a species, Sacramento pike minnow, that's native to California, but not native to the Eel River system. And so being a novel predator in the ecosystem has really allowed them to exploit the ecosystem in ways that, are very different than a native predator in an ecosystem.
Do we know how it got there?
We do, well, at least we have good hypotheses or guesses at it. And the thinking, it was introduced into Lake Pillsbury, which is the reservoir created by Scott Dam, and it was likely a bait bucket. Some genetic research suggests that the population in the Eel River came from just a handful of individuals. And so, yeah, it really shows you the risk of moving non-native species from one watershed to the other.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's because I know I've seen pike minnow in the Sacramento River, and they can get very large.
These fish can get close to 3 feet long. And they're interestingly native in the Russian River as well, which is, just the watershed to the south of the Eel, which was once connected to the Sacramento River system, historically through the Clear Lake area.
And as far as the green rush, as you put it, the marijuana growing industry, do you have any kind of idea of how much of that's going on now is legal compared to illegal growing in that area?
Well, the cannabis industry is going through some convulsions right now, I would say. Legalization has really changed the market for both legal and illegal cannabis. And the way I often explain it to people is, the Emerald Triangle is not necessarily the best place in the world to grow cannabis, right? It's not it's not wine country or something. You're not seeking out specific conditions there. You're seeking out the ability to hide, right, your crop because it used to be illegal. And so there's absolutely still a lot of illegal grows in this region, but there's also a lot of legacy grows. The market is again in flux, and so there's a lot of legacy illegal growers that have just up and abandoned their sites, and they're still having tremendous negative impacts on the ecosystem, and it's just going to take years for that sort of to work itself through, and those sites to be cleaned up or grown over or whatever.
And then, of course, we've been hearing a lot lately, especially on the Klamath, about dam removal in order to help the salmon population there. And, we know California Trout's been very involved with that. Tell us about plans for dam removal on the Eel River and why that should be done and what some of the issues are with that.
Yeah, we're really excited. I mean, it's a catalyst for additional change on the Eel. And again, I mentioned that hope, right? We are seeing a lot of positive change and sort of these impact historic impacts sort of starting to trend in a better direction. And yeah, dam the two dams located in the headwaters of the Eel River are definitely part of that. So these two dams, Scott and Cape Horn Dam, are part of a hydroelectric project called the Potter Valley Project that is now owned by Pacific Gas and Electric Company and has been for the last, oh, 60 or 70 years. Like many dams across the West and across the US, these dams were built sort of in the dam building boom of the early 1900s, up to sort of the 1950s. Cape Horn Dam, the older of the two dams, was built in 1906. And so, yeah, these are 100-year-old dams. PG&E, they're privately owned dams. Were built to generate hydroelectricity, and they just don't make money for the utility anymore. And so, PG&E has decided to remove them rather than relicense them. So these large hydroelectric dams typically operate on 30 to 50-year licenses, regulatory licenses from the federal government. And when those licenses come up for renewal, utilities have a decision to make. Are they going to relicense the project and keep operating it, or are they going to decide to do something else with them? And that's what's happened here. As PG&E tried to auction the project off, no one wanted to take it over. likely because they saw the same things PG&E sees, which is, this is a money-losing project. And so PG&E's made the decision and applied to the federal government for the ability to decommission the project and remove both of the dams.
And what are some of the ways that dams like those adversely affect the ecology of the river system?
Yeah, so I mean, the most obvious way is they block access to habitat, right? And in this case, it's really important habitat. So the two dams, as I mentioned, Cape Horn and Scott. Cape Horn Dam has a fish ladder on it, and that allows fish to pass above it. But 12 miles upstream is Scott Dam, which is the larger of the two dams, and it does not have fish passage on it. So all the habitat behind Scott Dam is blocked from fish being able to access it. And so, obviously for migratory species, running into a concrete wall isn't great. But what we care a lot about is the habitat behind the dam. And we've done several studies to try to understand how much habitat is up there. It's roughly a 300 square mile watershed above the dams. And to put that into context, it's roughly the size of the Gualala River or Redwood Creek, which is like Humboldt Redwoods State National Parks, if folks are familiar with that. So, it's roughly a medium-sized coastal watershed, blocked by these dams. And we've done some studies to look at the availability of habitat for specific salmonid species. And what those studies have shown is roughly 80 miles of habitat for Chinook salmon, again, those larger bodied salmon that prefer sort of larger rivers, and 288 miles of steelhead habitat. And this habitat's sort of disproportionately important in the Eel River because it's relatively high elevation. And so that allows it to have nice cool water, which salmon prefer. And also it's an important buffer against a changing climate, right? You want fish to be able to access that cold water with climate change warming our summers.
And is there a timeline on removal of these dams? Do we have any idea, like a goal for when that might be happening?
PG&E has stated that their goal would be to get a surrender order from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which again is that federal entity that regulates hydropower dams. They'd like to get a surrender order by 2028, which means construction could start or deconstruction could start within the next year or two. But all these timelines, it's hard to predict. There's a lot of permitting, there's a lot of studies that need to take place. Of course, we want these dams out as soon as possible to help these important fisheries recover, but we also want to make sure dam removal is done right. It's a big construction project, right? So we want to make sure that any impacts to the environment that happen during construction are mitigated and minimized to the greatest extent possible.
And I would imagine that you're learning a lot, we're learning a lot from what's going on in the Klamath with what happens in the aftermath of a dam removal. Could you maybe comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think to zoom out and take this into that broader context I mentioned, these aging dams are really going to become and are now, I would say, something that society just has to grapple with, right? I don't think when dams like these were built, the people that building them didn't really have an exit strategy in mind, right? They figured they'd be long gone before we had to deal with it, but if you look at, again, if you look at dams across the West, this is a problem that's going to come up time and time again, into the future. And like as you mentioned on the Klamath, we've learned a lot. We've also learned a lot from the Elwha and Sandy River. So each one of these dam removals that takes place is an enormous opportunity to figure out, the best way to do it, what the impacts are, and of course, any pitfalls or problems that might have occurred during dam removal. Yeah, and the Klamath, especially here in California, because there's so much expertise, and so many folks that worked on that, and certainly mentors to me that worked on Klamath dam removal. It really has been a surprising success, I think, for everyone that was involved, how quickly fish recolonized the habitats above the dam, and how much better the river looks in terms of water quality already, just a year plus after the project.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at the conservation issues revolving around the Eel River, the third largest watershed in California, with Charles Schneider from California Trout. I'm Dave Shlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Charles Schneider, Connectivity Program Manager for the nonprofit California Trout, as we talk about the challenges and opportunities involved in the restoration of the Eel River, California's third largest watershed and a vital aquatic ecosystem for the state's imperiled salmon and steelhead. Have there been some interesting restoration projects on the Eel River that the organization's been part of that you could point to as like, here's some things we've done and here's what's happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now we've taken on this really ambitious goal to work on a basin-wide restoration and conservation plan for the entirety of the Eel River. In terms of specific projects, Caltrout's been working in the Eel River really since our inception over 50 years ago. And I think a couple of the really exciting projects that, you know, we've either completed or are close to completing, you know, one is a large scale estuary reconnection project in the lower Eel. So right there in the estuary and, you know, ensuring that those habitats are reconnected. Like a lot of estuaries in California, portions of the Eel estuary have been diked and drained for agriculture. And so with dam removal, but also just, you know, more generally, we want to reconnect those estuarine habitats because it's such an important feeding area for juvenile salmon as they, you know, make their way out to the ocean. And we know from numerous studies that the bigger a baby salmon is when it goes out to the ocean, the greater likelihood it has of returning as an adult. So we really want to make sure those estuaries are healthy. And then we've worked on numerous, you know, smaller barrier removal projects across the Eel River. And, you know, again, just ensuring that all those tributary habitats are connected is also a really big mission of the organization because you just get such a good benefit for the cost of removing barriers and getting fish back into habitats that they weren't previously able to access.
And how about the pike minnow? Any projects going on to try to eradicate them from where they really shouldn't be?
Yeah, we're also leading on that effort. We've you know, the Wiat tribe whose ancestral lands are down in the lower river really started this effort to start looking at the pike minnow problem. And Caltrout's been employing researchers and partnering with Wiat tribe for several years now to really come up with some new ways to manage pike minnow. It's an enormous problem, like non-native species are in a lot of places. So over the last couple of years, we've run a weir in the South Fork Eel River. And the easiest way to think about a weir is it's essentially a fence in the river. And that weir, we've learned through studies that pike minnow migrate. They migrate downstream in the winter and then back upstream in the spring and summer to spawn. So we've been doing a lot of really sort of basic biological research on how pike minnow work in the Eel River and have found that this weir, you know, could be an effective approach to reducing their ability to spawn sort of higher up in the watershed, again, where salmon, you know, baby salmon want to be in the summer months.
Okay, let's talk a bit about some of the other stakeholders, people that you work with, Caltrout is aligning with to do this, because you can't do giant projects like this just on your own. Tell us about some of your partners.
Yeah, well, we mentioned Wiat Tribe, of course, on the pike minnow work. We've been working really closely with Round Valley Indian Tribes for several years now on that basin-wide restoration and conservation effort. And then on the dams, you know, one thing I didn't mention earlier is sort of one of the sticky societal issues associated with those dams is that they act as an out-of-basin diversion. So they take Eel River water and transfer it through the tunnel and penstocks, right, the power generation facilities, and that water is released into the Russian River watershed. And so this hydroelectric project has really supplemented Russian River water supplies for 100 years since its inception. And folks that have benefited from that, of course, don't really want to see that change, right? They've essentially been getting free water, you know, that's been provided by PG&E sort of as an externality of their operation of this project.
And what is that water primarily used for?
It's hard to say. You know, it mixes with the rest of the Russian River system. So, you know, as it leaves the tunnel, it comes out in Potter Valley itself, and it's predominantly used for agriculture, but of course for local supplies as well, for drinking water. Then it flows into Lake Mendocino on the Russian River system. Lake Mendocino is located just by Ukiah, and it's pretty high up on the Russian River system. And then it's sort of re-metered out from Lake Mendocino down the remainder of the Russian system. You know, and at that point, it really mixes with water, both from the Lake Mendocino watershed, and then, you know, once it's down the river, from all sorts of other tributaries. So no one's, I would say, as of what I've seen, no one's done a good job teasing out exactly how much Eel River water ends up, you know, in the lower Russian River, where the predominant population base is, you know, in Sonoma County and wine country. So say by and large ag, you know, some of it's certainly used for in-stream flow obligations in the Russian River, and also for, you know, municipal supplies as it gets sort of lower down the river. I think big picture, you know, when you add extra water to a watershed, it grows the pie, right? It reduces conflict over existing supplies. I think having that supplemental water has helped fuel growth in Sonoma and Mendocino counties. And so the possibility and the likelihood, I would say, of change here for folks in Sonoma and Mendocino counties has been really concerning for them. And, you know, we decided to really tackle that head on and start working with those water users to understand their needs and see if we could find, you know, a solution that did the greatest amount of good for the greatest number of people. And really came up with this idea called the Two Basin Solution. And so essentially what our plan is as PG&E is removing their two dams, which of course we support, there will be a new diversion structure built on the Eel River that will only divert water out of the Eel River when it's ecologically appropriate. So in the wet season, when water is abundant, and transfer that water to the Russian River watershed. And, you know, again, to keep Lake Mendocino, which is sort of the key part, key storage facility for the upper Russian River, keep Lake Mendocino reliably full, and, you know, maintain some of that supplementation of water supplies to the Russian River to sort of help people weather that, you know, pretty significant change. And, you know, when we talk about this aging infrastructure and it being sort of a big societal problem, how we modernize that infrastructure, right, to meet multiple benefits, I think is a really important piece of the work that we do. And we're really proud of the work that we've done with Sonoma Water and Mendocino Inland Water and Power Commission. Round Valley Indian Tribes is a big part of that effort as well. And Humboldt County and Trout Unlimited are our other partners in that effort. So it's a really interesting coalition. It's a really interesting solution to a water problem and a collaborative solution, which is just not something you always see in California. So I'm really proud of the work that we've done to try to come up with a better way to both recover the ecosystem and, you know, also get people the water they need.
Yeah, it's just such a complex issue when you look at so many different people in different parts of the river system, you know, wherever they are, you know, the benefits and costs to everybody. It's a complicated situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and people have different interests in the river, right? Some people care a lot about fisheries like me, or whitewater boating, or just having a healthy ecosystem. Other people care about recreation, you know, and certainly water users want to ensure reliable water supplies, both for drinking water, but also for agriculture, which is a big economic driver in this region. You know, these transbasin diversions, you know, they create interesting conflicts, right? Because you sort of have one basin that bears the costs. So the Eel River Basin has the dams, right? The water is taken out of the Eel River. And then you have another basin like the Russian that's really benefited from this, right? And that tends to set up conflict. So I think recognizing and addressing that conflict head on is really important in, you know, trying to reach some sort of consensus on, you know, issues like this.
Well, and I always look at, fisheries and fish populations as kind of the proverbial canary in the coal mine. If you have healthy river systems with healthy fish in them, that's good for everyone. When those things start to decline, that spells a disaster down the road for people too.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. Salmon are such a bellwether species for the health of our watersheds. And, if you care about drinking water, if you care about, watering your wine grapes, right, you want to see water in stream and that water to be of a high enough quality that you can, you can drink it or use it for irrigation. So yeah, a lot of the work we do is really focused on that bigger picture. I like to say salmon are charismatic megafauna, right? And that's why people are attracted to them. There's a lot of utility in salmon, of course. People like to eat them, but that bigger picture of watershed health is it's so much bigger than the fish, right? It means so much more to so many more people than just the salmon.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to, see that. The debate that went on for a long time that still comes up a bit, fish versus people and farmers and that conflict, it's kind of an artificial construct that, everybody needs healthy landscapes, period, or else, we can't thrive as a society without them.
Yeah, it's really about seeing other people and their interests and their needs, right? And as a salmon advocate, I just remind people it's not fish versus people, it's people versus people. And I think if you put it in that frame, salmon mean a lot to a lot of people, right? I, watched friends growing up sell their dad's boats because they knew they couldn't make it in the industry. That's a very personal impact from lack of healthy rivers.
And if somebody would like to learn, or our listeners would like to learn more about the Eel River and the work you're doing there, is there anywhere you could direct them if they perhaps want to get involved?
Yeah, caltrout.org is our website. You can hop in the search bar and type in Eel River. We've got several projects that we talked about here, from Eel River Dam removal, the pike minnow, to the restoration and conservation plan. So yeah, I would hop on our website. Lots of information there on sort of all our work in the basin and beyond.
Charlie Schneider, Connectivity Program Manager for California Trout. Thanks for sharing your interest and passion for the Eel River with us, the third largest watershed in California, something that I was not aware of before we started, investigating this.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks to our guest, California Trout Connectivity Program Manager, Charles Schneider. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll learn about a newly reborn and revitalized magazine beloved by anglers throughout the Golden State, California Fly Fisher. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. As an avid fly angler, I can tell you that aside from my next fishing trip, one of my favorite things is going out to the mailbox to find a new issue of California Fly Fisher magazine. I've been enjoying it for years, but a couple of years ago, I learned it was ceasing publication. Fortunately, my despair was short-lived as the magazine was reborn and refreshed with a beautiful new look, as well as a deeper focus on the natural history of the beautiful places where people like me like to chase wild fish. Our guests are the magazine's publisher, Tracy Diaz, and editor-at-large, George Revelle. They join us now. Tracy and George, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, thanks, David.
Thank you for having us.
I'd like to start with you, Tracy. Tell us a bit about the history of California Fly Fisher magazine and how you came to your position, because it's kind of an interesting story.
Yeah. So California Fly Fisher is when I decided to take it over. It was a 31-year-old publication. It was founded by Richard Anderson, who was the owner, publisher, editor, wore all the hats back in 1992. And it had established itself as really the community magazine for California fly fishers. Over the years, it had some, really influential contributors like Russell Chatham, Ralph and Lisa Cutter, Hal Jansen, just some really, really great writers that people became to know and love. And so he was publishing that magazine. And then in October of 2023, he just put in the last page of the issue a letter saying, you know, that's it. I'm retiring and this is the last issue. And it sort of took everybody by surprise.
As a subscriber who just like, I don't know, a couple of years before that started getting the magazine, for me, it was like Christmas morning when I would go out to the mailbox and that quarterly appearance of that magazine was like, oh yes, my California fly fisher. And then when I saw that note at the end of the magazine, I was like, oh no, my favorite thing's being taken away.
Yeah, you and pretty much everybody else that you know was getting the magazine.
So tell us about your decision to, you know, reboot it.
Yeah. So at the time I was working at California Trout as the director of development and communications. So I was familiar with the magazine. We advertised in it and I'd gotten to know Richard well over the years and, you know, knew that he had built this strong brand with a really dedicated community, you know, as you were just mentioning. And so Cal Trout had introduced me to the world of fly fishing and I was familiar with that side of things. And then I had started my career in advertising and marketing. I worked in media planning on the agency side of things, and then for some national magazines doing ad sales. And, you know, as silly as it sounds, I also, from eighth grade all the way through college, was the editor of the yearbook. So I was familiar with, you know, the process of putting a publication together. So it felt like when I was deciding whether to do this or not, and I think I was flipping my mind every hour, just about every day, but, you know, it felt like the opportunity had bundled up everything I'd done in my career in this one thing to be able to resurrect a brand that had such a passionate following. So I felt like I had the business side of things nailed, but not the fly fishing knowledge. You know, I did not and still do not have the fly fishing knowledge of what it would take to publish the magazine. So approached George about it and really wasn't going to do it without if George couldn't be involved in some way. He is a board member at California Trout. So I had known him, gotten to know him over the 12 years I was there. And yeah, we talked about it and it had turned out that George was actually toying around with the idea of possibly acquiring it as well. So it was, you know, just one of those things that
serendipity.
Meant to be. Yeah, exactly. Serendipity. So
George, tell us a bit about your background. You own and operate Lost Coast Outfitters, which sounds like it should be way up on the Lost Coast of Northern California, but it's actually in a pretty big city. Tell us about your background.
Yeah, we get a lot of questions about the name of Lost Coast Outfitters, but I named it Lost Coast Outfitters because I know what I, you know, every day when I come to work, I need to know what I'm working towards, which is a cabin on the Lost Coast.
Which is where for people who don't know?
That's like from Shelter Cove to Petrolia, like the most remote part of and least populated part of California. So I love California. I love everything about it, but the 38 million people can be a lot sometimes. So the least densely populated part of California is where I aspire to someday live and garden and fish and do all those things. So.
And yet your fly shop is in San Francisco.
Yeah, and we're in downtown San Francisco, which is technically the Barbary Coast is where we are. But it doesn't have the same ring to it. So Lost Coast is a better ring.
And tell us about your reaction when Tracy approached you to become involved in the reboot of this magazine.
Well, first it was like, thank God, because there's no way I wanted to do this alone. And I would follow Tracy into war. As soon as she was involved, I was 100% in. But I still very vividly remember the conversation when she's like, you know, some friends were thinking about buying the magazine and We're wondering, we're wondering if maybe you would be the editor. And I was like, oh, that's funny. I was thinking about buying it too. And she looks at me and goes, my friends are me. and so I had to laugh and, like I said, I'd fall Tracy into war, anywhere. And, I knew it would be successful if she was involved, and I'm very happy to play a role in that.
Tracy, can you describe George's role for us? What does he bring to the table for you?
Yeah. So George is editor at large. I mean, I'd love to have him just have the editor title, and he really should, but obviously he's got a full-time job with Lost Coast Outfitters as well. And so many other things that he gets involved in, but
he likes to go fishing once in a while.
And he likes to go fishing once in a while, but George is truly gives the vision for the magazine and just has such a strong sense of what is going to appeal to the readers and the fly fishers around the state and, you know, where we can guide things, what we should be covering. So yeah, he's got that, obviously. He's got such a successful fly shop, and that's no accident, because he just really knows this community and what they're going to be interested in. So he guides the editorial. We also have an editorial committee that, again, when we were first thinking of doing this, we said, well, let's pull together the people that, are all across the state that we can gather with every so often and throw around the ideas of what we should be covering, what the trends are, what they find interesting. And so we have a editorial committee of about a dozen people, from guides to industry folks to just, fishy people around the state that help guide the editorial.
And George, for a lot of people, if they think about fly fishing, they might think, oh, well, that's something people do in Montana. What makes California such a special place that it deserves its own magazine about fly fishing?
I mean, I think the same thing that makes California great, in its own right, essentially the diversity of species, geology, and people that live here. And the major reason I have my fly shop in downtown San Francisco is literally for that diversity, whether it's going out for lunch or the people who walk through my door who are just fishing all over the world, not just here in California, which, we have a lot of people who love fishing here in California, but they're going to travel, take the lessons learned here all over the world. And so California is really whether you're fishing for salmon, steelhead, trout, carp, bass, striped bass, all the different saltwater species, surf perch, corbina, the amount of diversity here in California, even just the Sierra Range splitting, cutthroat and rainbows and all the diversity in the species of trout. It's really incredible. And you just have people who take things to kind of a higher level, than I see what's out in Montana in terms of techniques and whether it's casting, fly tying, how to rig, different fishing techniques. You have a lot of highly successful people thinking constantly about how to make things better. And I think that's part of California culture in general. And it bleeds into our fishing life as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And Tracy, I'm curious, because I get asked this all the time. How do you come up with the ideas for the guests for your show? And when you've got a magazine, you've got to fill it with content. And, articles and different things and columns and articles and photographs, all of those things that have to be done. Can you give us a sense of kind of the process you go to like, okay, this is our goal for this next issue coming out in, say, summer?
Yeah. No, that's a great question. As I mentioned, we have this great group of editorial committee members, and we just throw around ideas. And so they come from not only that editorial committee, but also people who submit their ideas to be published in the magazine. So we do get quite a few submissions and story ideas that way too. And then George and I meet and sort of hash out what's going to go into each issue, focusing on the destinations, which, as George was saying, I mean, I'll just back up and say, reiterate what George said, that there's no shortage of topics, of species, of places, of techniques. I mean, it just blows my mind how much there is to cover. So So we meet and just sort of flesh out what's going to be going into each issue, from destinations to tips and techniques to profiles, and yeah, try to chart that out looking 3 or 4 issues ahead.
The process starts typically with Tracy and I on a ton of 3x5 note cards, and we lay them all out on the table. And that's what happens before it goes into Figma, is we lay out all our 3x5 note cards and start figuring out what the major buckets are going to be, like what's the feature destination that we're going to talk about. And then also think about who's going to be a good potential writer or a list of good potential writers to target for that article. And then, you know, and then we start filling in stuff around that, you know, making sure we're covering the vast geographic expanse of California. So, you know, we have Northern California, we have, you know, Central California and Southern California is kind of how we think about it. And then we have different types of water. We've got the ocean, we have rivers, we have lakes. And so making sure we're trying to create a well-rounded magazine that covers, you know, all of that diversity in each issue, so that no matter where you are in California, there's going to be something that is immediately applicable to you, and then also relevant from a time of year standpoint as well.
Yeah, we're coming to your close to your home next. We're going to do Sacramento in this upcoming spring issue. So
another thing that I find interesting about this new version of the magazine is when you have a destination, like the cover story, you also get into not just the fishing aspect, but the natural history, the geology. There's beautiful paintings by Obi Kaufman. I could talk a little bit about the decision to kind of include that, because I love that.
Yeah, well, actually, I think it was George's idea to do a field note. So that column is called Field Notes. And what we do in each issue, we have what we call our spotlight destination. And so we dive a little bit further into that area and include a field notes column, which does exactly what you had mentioned, sort of a naturalist column, where we have our geologist, Jeff Ludlow, write about what shaped and formed that river or certain geography. And then we'll bring in someone to look at talk about the birds in the area or the flowers or just something that you might also experience when you're out there fishing. And I think part of that is because, you know, you hear all the time about how people who fly fish are doing it for more than just the experience of catching a fish. You know, it's about being out in nature and the beautiful places that fly fishing takes us with good friends. And it's really about that whole experience. So we want to give the readers that broader perspective and, you know, help them get curious about the world around them. And yeah, I love that column. And Obi Kaufman's illustrations just add such a beautiful touch to it.
Well, before we let you go, George, we were talking earlier in this program about the Eel River with Charlie Schneider from California Trout. And I know you have been and fished in that area a lot. Tell us from your perspective, what makes that fishery, the Eel River, chasing steelhead there, what makes it so special to you?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that the setting as a whole, you know, if you can't help but have your blood pressure drop in just about in half when you're standing in a river flanked by, you know, 300-year-old redwoods. But, you know, what really makes that place special, I think, is, you know, how, well, one, it goes pretty far from the coast, but I fish it a lot, the lower section of the Eel, you know, from where the South Fork meets the main stem Eel, and just the proximity to the ocean and the fish that you connect with there are so unbelievable. And just, I mean, it's like touching lightning. These fish are fresh in from the ocean, and they have that vigor and vibrance that they get in the ocean. And it's so fresh in them, and their fins are translucent, and they're just absolutely dime bright and full of cartwheels and backflips and long runs. And just like any fishery I find myself on here in California, we're relatively new as a state, right? People haven't been here that long, or European settlers have not been in California for a very long time and in such a short period of time. And, you know, I talk to people who remember the eel maybe one generation removed, but that story talk from the people who were up there in the early 1900s, what that river looked like, it was more akin to the Smith River than it is to its current version. So spending a lot of time thinking about what it used to be. And that river was absolutely incredible. It is a shadow of its former self, yet it's still spectacular. So all those things are running through my head. And then the idea of the potential of removing the Potter Valley Dam up north and opening up just tons of spawning habitat for salmon and steelhead and giving cold water back to the river and what that potential represents is truly, truly incredible. The geology changes so much. You can be on one cliff where the ocean floor has been pushed up and there's these massive seashell fossils sticking out into, you know, the more gravelly sections of it with, you know, 40 foot deep swirls up above the forks that are just massive, massive boulders, the biggest boulders you've ever seen sitting in the middle of them. There's so much diversity in that river from a landscape perspective. It's unbelievable.
Tracy Diaz, publisher, and George Revell, editor at large for California Fly Fisher magazine. Best of luck with the magazine in the future going forward and with all of your endeavors.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests from California Trout Connectivity Program Manager Charles Schneider. You can learn more about their conservation efforts on the Eel River and throughout the state at caltrout.org. And thanks to the guiding forces behind California Fly Fisher Magazine, publisher Tracy Diaz and editor-at-large George Revell. You can check out the magazine at calflyfisher.com. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Chico State Enterprises and licensed to California State University Chico in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler, for all of us here. I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.